So it's an impairment of US $1.3 billion. So to remind,
knocked IGO out of the water. Yeah, with their impairment.
Trying to one up them. So
get one up your dogs.
I'm struggling to look past that number. 1.3 billion US. That's 1.9 billion Aussie. They bought Arizona Mining and they paid that 1.3 in cash. Money's gone into the ground and yeah, they haven't extracted any value from the asset yet.
Well, they've technically, if you look at the number, they've taken money out of the ground.
Core Lithium.
I'm happy to talk about this one, which I don't have skin in the game, thankfully.
You know, we occasionally look at the most shorted stocks on the exchange, on
this
the
is
ASX.
Number two. Yeah, the announcement today is the quarterly, and stock is down 15% intraday. Smack.
We listened to the quarterly this morning.
Or the quarterly.
Oh, I thought it was a...
That was a good one.
That was good, mate. That was good.
Oh, I got it.
Money Miners, welcome to another week, Monday, 24th of July. Jada, you're finally repping a bloody Hooteroo hat, mate.
Mate, it's not the first time.
We need to get that red and white beanie to bloody fit that Where's Wally description that someone put to you on Twitter.
I'll leave that one in your hands.
Happy to help. Ricky Ardo, how are you, good sir?
Hey, mate, I'm well, except for the fact that Jada's stolen my hat. You know, you're happy to wear one now, but you didn't bring your bloody own. You just asked if you could use mine.
I'm sharing the love. I'm letting other people wear the hat, spreading the good word of Money of Mine.
Unbelievable.
Good work, boys. Right, let's get into it. Jam-packed episode today, buddy. God. South 32, SolGold, Gascoigne, MinRes, Bald Hill. Shit loads to talk about. It's all bloody exciting. I'm feeling good.
Core Lithium too.
Core Lithium. Core Lithium.
So we're all around the world, all different commodities, all different issues, you know, quarterlies, impairments.
I'm feeling good energy for this episode.
Me too. I'm pumped.
Right, let's rip it. South 32, the write down for the Hermosa project in Arizona. My brief time at Cannington, South 32, where I made a fool of myself because I didn't know what I was doing. That's just after they bought that. They bought that asset just before.
I had your time at Cannington in my mind. I was going to bring it up.
I don't really want to remember it.
And you say brief. How brief was it, Matty?
Oh, 6 months.
Yeah.
Bloody, yeah, no good, didn't fit in. They didn't like my swearing. I didn't fit into a BHP sort of company lifestyle.
Yeah, okay.
Mm. Well, it was South 32?
It was South 32 then, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So for those wondering, this Hermosa asset is near Tucson, Arizona. Now, do you guys know what Hermosa means in Spanish?
I feel like it sounds pretty similar to samosa, which
I was thinking it's not champagne and orange juice.
It means beautiful. Mimosa. It means beautiful, but this announcement is far from beautiful. So,
what's ugly in Spanish?
You're testing my knowledge there. So, it's an impairment of US $1.3 billion. So, to remind.
Knocked IGO out of the water with their impairment.
Trying to one-up them. So
get one up, your dogs.
The Hermosa asset is comprised of Taylor and Clark. So they're both polymetallic assets. Taylor is zinc, lead, silver, and it's a sulfide deposit. And Clark is zinc, manganese, silver, and it's an oxide deposit. So I'm struggling to look past that number. 1.3 billion US, that's 1.9 billion Aussie. Last time I checked, South 32 were capped at 16 for just sort of, and 16 Aussie just for reference. But the market sort of reaction, it's been pretty muted. They're only off a couple percent. So that sort of leads me to think it's kind of priced in. People sort of saw this coming. So the carrying value, that's this sort of accounting expression for what this is going to represent on the balance sheet going forward, is 480 million US for Taylor. And Clark plus the exploration grounds is US 520, so 1 billion all up now. And just a reminder, that carrying value, obviously it's different from the fair or the market value that you see. So, Matty.
And so you said they've paid, what they pay, 1.6 billion for it?
We're going to get into that now. So if you sort of cast your mind back to the good old days when you were in balmy Queensland working at Cannington and in June 2018, that's when they bought this asset. So they bought Arizona Mining, who were the owners of this asset. Now, when they bought it, they'd already owned 17-odd percent. So they went in and bought the remaining 83%. And they paid US $1.3 billion for that remaining portion. So they valued the whole company at $1.6 billion.
Yeah.
And they paid that $1.3 in cash. So,
And then they would have spent a bit of money in the ground since then as well, right?
Absolutely. They didn't buy a producing asset, you know. So I guess getting to the sort of the real question, why have they written down the value of this asset so much? The company sort of points to three main things. They've got COVID-related delays. So they bought this, like I said, in June 2018. Just a lot of delays sort of hindering how soon they see the cash flow. They had quite a bit of like necessary dewatering that they had to do. Again, delaying production and, like you sort of touch on, Trav, requiring significant capital expenditure. And then
COVID delays would have been a lot worse in America than they were in Australia, I'd nearly assume.
Yeah, America's an interesting one. It was, from my understanding, very state by state. Oh, so yeah. I can't speak specifically to what was going on in Arizona at the time. But yeah, higher capex across the board from all different sort of reasons, like COVID being the main one, the dewatering, increased cost of cement, steel, electrical components, everything sort of working against them, like we touched on with IGO.
Interesting one, mate. Very interesting. I remember opening up a presentation that came across the ASX platform. I think it was on the 26th of May, and it was an updated presentation just going through all of the elements of this Hermosa project. Very pretty site visit, all the growth options, very conceptual in nature. So I flicked to the page where it said Taylor PFS summary. My eyes are looking there, looking. Where's NPV? Where's IRR? Not there. Couldn't find it. South 32 just didn't think we needed to know those numbers, so didn't include them. And only companies like South 32 can really get away with that in a PFS. And maybe now we know why those numbers weren't included.
Have they ever been released?
Actually, I don't know, Matty. I haven't done a deep dive. Maybe back in the day of a prior study, there might have been a scoping study or something along those lines. But
did you have a look at what the brokers were sort of marking out?
Well, this is the other interesting thing in relation to South 32. I did notice that just 4 days ago, so 20th of July, JP Morgan, they put out their mid-year prospects, and they pointed to South 32 as their top pick. And the reason that they highlighted South 32 as their top pick is one of the reasons was because it was only trading at 0.84 times NAV. Now their NAV that they're using was a sum of the parts valuation of 20.7 billion Aussie, which included Aussie 2.3 billion for Hermosa. So it might be a tad bit more fully valued now that we've had these write downs.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
if you sum it up, they valued the company at $1.6 billion 5 years ago.
Yep.
Now the company is essentially that project is now valued at $1 billion US in today's terms. So they've paid the $1.3 in cash, what they owned already. They've put more money into the ground in this 5 years, and then now the value of the project is back to $1 billion after all of that.
Yeah, and you're not even factoring in like
the discount rate on the money as well over 5 years.
You're expecting a return on your investment, and there's inflation and all that sort of stuff.
Like you exactly say there, Manny, money's gone into the ground and they haven't extracted any value from the asset yet.
Well, they've technically, if you look at the number, they've taken money out of the ground. in a way.
That's one way of putting it.
There's a few mining projects out there that do that.
Oh, right.
SolGold.
Now, this is one of the big upcoming copper gold porphyry deposits in the world.
Yep.
She's a humdinger in Ecuador.
About this project except for the fact that it's in Ecuador, right? It's just a phenomenal, phenomenal, phenomenal deposit. Except for the fact that it's in Ecuador,
and probably the Chinese involvement as well, which will go in creates that extra
we'll
element.
Touch on the bigger shareholders. So SolGold is TSX and LSE listed, despite having quite an Australian company as well when it comes to management and such. So they capped it a bit over £500 million, which is a touch under a billion Aussie at the moment. And on those big shareholders, Matty, so you've got the former Cornerstone and Maxit Capital. If you look at their latest presentation, they group these all together, which is kind of interesting. And that combines for just under 23% ownership. Then you've got BHB at a bit over 10, as well as Newcrest at a bit over 10. And then there's quite a few more substantial holders who have sort of stakes of less than 7%, sort of trickling down from there.
I think, is this a good time for a bit of irrelevant history with Matty?
Let's I think it is. I think it's.
Yeah, boys, you've had a whole weekend without it. I just don't. I know you're probably like meth heads wanting your next hit.
I haven't got a jingle yet, mate. So we'll have to just do it on the spot.
Yes, I know. Well,
so where does the story start for you, Matty?
Well, there was a bit of action in it the end of last year, around October. So because that's when Soul Gulch merged with that Cornerstone Resources to get 100% ownership of Cusabel. So and when they merged, this diluted. So BHP and Newcrest were already shareholders. That diluted their shareholding to 13.5% each. Then 7th of November last year, so they secured Solgold secured a $50 million in royalty funding from Osisko Gold Royalties for a 0.6% net smelter return for the project. So, and this BHP and Newcrest were going off their head about it because they said it was a very expensive way to get financing.
Totally.
Yeah.
And then, you're encumbering the economics of the project in like perpetually with this, right? And then BHP and Newcrest both are thinking of the scenario where they get 100% of the asset, and now they're like that's 0.6% off of the top line that
for a potentially 50 plus year mine life.
It's horrible.
Well, then 3 days after that, they did that royalty deal. Managing director Daryl Kasubo left the company effective immediately.
Wow!
So that's where a lot of the news was coming out. Then in December they did a $36 million capital raise, and the new investor was Jiangxi Copper. If I was going to pronounce it Aussie, it'd be Jiangxi, Hong Kong. So they are a Hong Kong-based investment company. So then that capital raise saw them take 6.3% of Solgold's ordinary share capital. So yeah, BHP and Newcrest, like there were talks that they were going to do a merger, like a JV for this project. Then the Chinese interests come in, but look, massive project, estimated annual copper production of 132,000 tonnes, 358,000 ounces of gold and 1 million ounces of silver per annum. So free cash flow estimated at $740 million a year for 50 plus years. So she's a big humdinger of a project, big block cave.
Huge.
So, and that's where the $2.7 billion capex comes into it.
Yeah, so I think the Ecuadorian government, I think they put some numbers around what they – think the asset could be in terms of scale, and they classed it as potentially the world's biggest silver mine, third biggest gold mine, and sixth biggest copper mine. So that's massive. So the reserves, kind of touching on what you spoke about there, Maddie, show 30 million ounces of silver, 9.4 million ounces gold, and 3.3 million tons of copper. And exactly like you said, US 2.7 billion capex. After-tax NPV, US $2.9 billion for an IRR of a bit over 19%. So importantly, the announcement today, they've got a lot of the approvals. That's environmental and water permits. You know, they've got that all. So if construction does sort of start as they want it to in 25, they can be producing by 2030. I think it'd be really fascinating to see if Ecuador can kind of replicate what we see a lot of in Peru and even more so in Chile, just becoming a really big exporter of commodities, you know, in particular copper, in parts gold as well. So
if they don't nationalise.
Yeah. So, I mean, Chile in that example is an interesting one. They have a national copper company in Codelco, but they have private ownership of copper assets as well. And obviously the whole fuss that we've heard about with Ecuador. So there's been a huge hindrance in Ecuador for a long time, and it's sort of specifically relates to indigenous approvals. So that's why, you know, this sort of announcement and announcements similar are quite a big deal. So if you sort of think about big Ecuadorian projects, a couple come to mind. Fruta del Norte, which is owned by the Lundin, the Canadian Gold Group, and they produce 340,000 ounces. And
is that the Lundins that Rick Rule referenced?
Is there only one Lundin family?
That's the Lundins.
So that's run by the third generation from the sort of patriarch of the Lundin family.
Yep.
And then the Mirador asset as well, that produces 62,000 tonnes of copper, 34,000 ounces of gold, and a bit under 400,000 ounces of silver. And that's jointly owned by a few different Chinese parties.
Some big operations there. I remember when we had Warren Irwin come on our podcast in the first month we were doing this, I think, he was a big shareholder of Cornerstone. at the time, which ultimately that they were the minority JV partner who ended up merging with SolGold here.
At Cornerstone's a confusing name.
It is. Yeah, because it's like, you're talking the Cornerstone or Cornerstone?
Yeah, it was a company named Cornerstone. So Cornerstone had the TSX listing and SolGold had the LSE listing. The two merged and now you've got a TSX and an LSE. At the time, Warren was sounding pretty frustrated because of what appeared to be the inability to sell the project to a Chinese group. And he was sort of indicating that Canadian regulators were the roadblock just simply because Cornerstone had a TSX listing. And you can see in SolGold's public announcements, one in February, that they say that a strategic review is still underway. Strategic review means sale process in my mind, or partnering process of some description. So
it's super interesting that Warren brought that up in a case like this, because that would be the Canadian government stopping this transaction, and this isn't an asset that's in Canada. It makes a whole lot of sense if it's, you know, in British Columbia or in Ontario, but
yeah,
like this is obviously, it's a Canadian listed group, but it's an Ecuadorian asset, so it's super interesting.
It just speaks to that theme of the geopolitical tension in securing critical minerals projects.
Absolutely. And like this asset, you know, what you touched on, almost 50 years potential mine life. They got 26 planned out at the moment, 25 million tonne per annum processing plant.
That's fucking huge. Block cave.
Like that's got major written all over it. So that's why BHP are on the register. That's why Newcrest are on the register. So to be really fascinating to see how that plays out.
Well, it's going to, especially you got the Chinese in there with a stake as well. But, and Newmont, well, when all this was happening last year, this was before the Newmont takeover of Newcrest. So now it's going to be technically Newmont will own that 10 and a bit percent with BHP. So look, is there a bloody JV opportunity? Newmont have got probably a better US base, you'd say, North America base than BHP.
So speaking of Chinese geopolitical dynamics, Mineral Resources came out with a bit of an announcement. I think it was Friday. Was it Thursday? One of the days we didn't do the show. But what did you make of that, right? Because there's some real read-through in their announcement that came up.
Yeah, a lot of interesting different angles. And like while we're on the theme of geopolitics, that was perhaps the most interesting. So what they've really done is rejigged the Albemarle JV again. So this deal was first signed, I think, in November 2019. And it's been, you know, constantly rejigged as each of the companies have invested more in different sorts of assets. So I guess you could say after this announcement, they're perhaps not quite as intertwined with Albemarle anymore. So they've sold down their stake in Kemerton. That's the downstream facility near Bunbury, which processes the lithium that comes from Greenbushes.
And they're selling that to Albemarle.
To Albemarle, yep. So from 15% MinRes ownership to zero from memory. And they're now looking to fund their own downstream. We're going to hear more about that later. They've spoken a lot about wanting to do that in Australia. Chris Ellison, obviously the founder of the company, has been pressing the governments, both state and federal, pretty hard on, you know, getting the right incentives and tax credits in sort of place. And he's been pretty frustrated on that part. And he was also, you know, they've been working over the last couple of years to try and do something with Albemarle up near Wodgina. But that hasn't happened. The Americans weren't so keen on doing something up near there, or that was the sort of rhetoric we were kind of hearing. But we are now hearing that within the next 5 months, they're going to make a call on what they're doing downstream. So on the theme of Wodgina, this deal has seen them tick up their ownership to, I think, from 40 to 50%. So it's definitely now at 50% ownership in Wodgina.
So down Kemerton.
So it's like a percentage swap, pretty much. Yeah, they've swapped their Kemerton and Wodgina percentages.
Yeah, so sold down Kemerton, increased ownership at Wodgina, but also they're going to get US 380 to 400 million in cash from Albemarle.
And is
because
there
they've also, on the Chinese front, selling out of the interest they had in two processing facilities in China.
And that was an agreement that was made not that long ago, right?
No, earlier this year.
Earlier this year, MinRes, there's an agreement to, you know, invest in these downstream processing facilities in China, and now this is a real pivot away from that strategy. It's a bold one in that, and I think it looks to us like the real drivers of this pivot in strategy in a short period of time are geopolitical.
Yeah, so they did make it pretty clear that they're opening an office in China to market their product, but opening an office is nowhere near as of an investment as having ownership in processing facilities. And I don't think it entirely rules them out from doing stuff in other Asian nations. You know, we've seen deals with Pilbara and POSCO in, you know, there's other Southeast Asian as well as, you know, Korea and Japan where downstream could potentially happen. So that's a sort of, I guess, a negotiating chip that they could play with the Australian government to see where something ends up getting produced in respect to mineral resources.
And wasn't there, because there was the Ganfeng with Mount Marion, didn't they? What was the
they,
news?
They cancelled the offtake there.
Cancelled the offtake with them as well. Yeah. So that was,
which
what,
was
a month
set
or so
to
ago?
And in 12 months later. But yeah, yeah, and yep. You're right. So there's all these signs pointing to a degree of disconnecting their final product from being you know, from having China as its final destination. I think what the drivers of this that, you know, we can speak to are the Inflation Reduction Act, where the more value that is captured in countries that are on the good list, so to speak, they will, like those the ultimate product that goes into the batteries, they'll be eligible for more of these like tax credits for the in the sale of electric vehicles in the US market, and hence you're going to see more of the value capture accrue in these okay countries in order to not be penalized. So I think that's what this strategy is doing.
Well, let's look at the scenarios, because I know his comments were talking about the potential for as you said, JD, the downstream processing in Australia, which it looks like they want to be theirs, not a JV, but and then they've got that office in China. So it looks like their options are they're either going to just sell their spodumene concentrate as a concentrate, not take the downstream, or they want to build a downstream processing in Australia. So it looks like they're keeping their options open.
Yeah, Ellison has been pretty vocal.
They're not committed to anything.
Yeah, he has been pretty vocal on wanting to go downstream and having that full, you know, vertical integration.
Yeah.
So it sort of have to wait and see how that entirely plays out. I mean, when you think about it, a lot of the downstream processing is in joint venture, you know, between various different companies. It's a, you know, from what we sort of hear, it's quite a bit of technical sort of know-how. You need quite a bit of expertise you need to execute that stage well. So it would be very interesting to see, you know, if they do that on their own. It doesn't rule them out, I guess, from doing it with another Western aligned country, to your point, Trav. We just have to wait and see.
We've got another geopolitical story, Shady, and another lithium geopolitical story.
And another one, well, one where the government's getting involved in this case, FIRB. So they rejected Austroid's bid for Alita Resources. Now, for investors out there, Alita might sound familiar because they are the owner of Bald Hill.
What an enigma. It's an enigma that you bring into the news, JD.
Yeah. The lithium mine near Kalgoorlie that no one knows anything about.
And I guess it's an enigma to your point, Maddie, because it went into administration in August 2019. And when a company's in administration, like similar to a private company in a way, you don't hear as much. So Bald Hill is 60-odd kilometres southeast of Kambalda. So I think a bit over 100 or so southeast of Kalgoorlie. And it has a resource, what had a resource back in the day, of 26.5 million tonnes at about 1% lithium and 150 parts per million tantalum pentoxide. So they were ASX listed and Singaporean listed.
How did it get delisted? Like what happened there?
I don't know the specific ins and outs, but I mean, you can still go back and find quarterly reports and such up until mid to late 2019. But when you see more recent articles, they say Singaporean listed. So it obviously doesn't have that Aussie listing that it still has. So
the key thing, though, operating. It was an operating lithium mine.
It was. It was one of the first, I guess, operating lithium mines, you know, one of the first few operating lithium mines in Western Australia. And it got wiped out in that sort of late 2018, 2019 lithium bear market, when, you know, back when spodumene prices were below $1,000 a tonne.
Oh, I wouldn't even get out of bed for that these days, would they?
No, you wouldn't.
Jesus Christ.
So, yeah, like I said, voluntary administration in late 2019. So what's really happened today is Austroid wanted to take over Alita Resources. They previously owned 9.9%. They wanted to take that up to 100% equity ownership. Austroid Australia is the subsidiary of US-based Austroid, but it's actually Chinese-owned. So they thought going the US route would make it, I guess, friendlier from a Ferb point of view.
If and we have a Chinese company, we can get around Ferb.
Oh, yeah. Look, I hope they don't connect the dots that we're Chinese owned.
So obviously it didn't work out too well. The government and Ferb, they don't explicitly state why they've rejected the deal, but I mean, it seems pretty clear to us, doesn't it? Mm. So limited mining actually started last year again. And when it's running at nameplate, when it's fully operational again, it's meant to be going at 155,000 tonnes of spodumene concentrate plus a bit of tantalum too. And going off the 2019 June quarterly, they shipped at 6.2% concentrate grade. Now, that's pretty good. If we compare it with Mount Marion, MinRes, who we were speaking about before, what were they?
It's just north of three. It's like three.
Off
like
of the concentrate. Three and four.
Yeah, they can't. Oh, they've got horrible grade there. They can't get it.
That's one of the issues they're having from what I understand. Yeah. So
a lot of them run at 5.5, don't they? That's
low fives, 5.5.
Yeah, but Mount Marion's particularly weak.
So there's another really juicy angle to this one. It's the royalty payments. So the WA Mines Department, they're not happy with these guys. They've accused them of shifting profits to China and, you know, in turn, minimising the necessary royalty payments. So they sort of do that by signing an offtake and paying far below what the actual market price is to this party. So it's unclear what the specific relationship between, you know, Alita or technically Lithco, who's operating the mine now, and the offtake partner is. They, I think, maintain that there's no relationship, as it were, there.
We'll just give you a bargain.
Yeah. Our WA government charges a 5% royalty on lithium concentrate exports. So that's 5% off the revenue.
That's juicy.
That is revenue. Chunky, yeah. So there was a deal actually to sell Bald Hill in late 2019, shortly after it had gone into administration.
Before the lithium bull market kicked in, right?
Exactly. And that was going to go to a Chinese group, but it fell over and there was a lot of, you know, uncertainty around why that fell over. Now, this aspect is super interesting. Galaxy Resources, before the merger with Orica Obre, made a move and they scooped up the debt from Alita. That's really interesting. But they eventually sold that to China Hydrogen Energy. So
they must have changed their mind. They scooped up the debt, presumably with the intention to get the asset and then changed their mind and then on-sold the debt.
Yeah, I'd love to get more insight into what the sort of thinking there was. This was, like you say, Trav, before the big run-up in lithium prices again. So it wasn't sort of clear that this would be a home run if they could turn that into equity ownership.
Yep.
But this group, China Hydrogen Energy, known as CHEL, they then sold this on to Austroid and then it kind of gets opaque. But at the time, there was roughly $53 million owed and that was around the time that Galaxy sold the debt to CHEL. So I guess the big question is, who's going to scoop up Bald Hill now? Canaccord have put sort of numbers at $1.5 billion valuation on the asset. But I would flag that they're not totally impartial. They were equity holders in Alita and they've got some ongoing legal proceedings on the sort of case as well.
Yeah, I read some article that where, you know, Canaccord have got some lawyers involved to argue that the docker that was approved had some provision for if lithium recovered, the equity holders had some economic interest in the project to come back. So the equity gets a second chance according to these lawyers. So anyway, I'm not sure what the docker says. But
yeah, we'll have to wait and see how that plays out. Another interesting point is that Austroid, being the debtors, they bought that debt. It just makes the whole thing more complex because not only did they buy that debt, but they've invested supposedly up to almost $200 million more into the asset over the past couple of years. So that means, you know, they would, you know, while they can't get ownership here, according to Ferb, they are owed something or should have some sort of stake, or whether that's just the debt that they hold and they were loans to the company. It's all pretty opaque how that kind of plays out. So I think the last thing just to talk about with regard to Bald Hill again is the geopolitical angle.
And whenever we say geopolitical, it means China. Pretty much every geopolitical thing is something to do with China. Yeah,
non-Western aligned. You know, I don't think Russia's exactly in the good books either, but they're not exactly
China, Russia, active here. North Korea.
Yeah. So
everywhere else is all good.
there's plenty of assets that are Chinese-Australian or Chinese-American joint ventures in the Australian lithium and mining sector. So it's not totally new. And with regard to lithium, they just boss downstream. I think, isn't it like 96% of downstream for like processing for lithium is done in China.
It's all in China. None of the downstream for lithium is anywhere else yet. It's coming.
So Jim Chalmers, he not too long ago blocked a Chinese fund from buying into Northern Minerals, And as we touched on before, MinRes are also sort of de-Chinering their business.
But all the minerals is a heavy rare earths.
Yeah.
Yeah. Minor. Yeah. Yep.
But it's just got to be done super, super delicately. The whole thing is fascinating. I mean, we saw just a couple of years ago the retaliation that came from our government sort of wanting to back a investigation into the causes behind COVID. And that led to all these tariffs and such on wine, barley, coal, lobsters, everything. And there was a lot of Aussie businesses that they were hurting quite a bit, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a delicate one for governments to sort of tiptoe around.
That's going to be an interesting region to keep an eye on anyway, with the because you got Mount Marion, like because this Bald Hill would just fit into that region with MinRes. So you got Bald Hill, Essential, Mount Marion. You've got that's where Liontown's got their Baldania thing down there. You've got a bit of exploration going with Lightning Minerals and Lovato, I think. So
Global Lithium's not too far away.
Yeah. So it would definitely suit MinRes for that area, but it looks extremely complex.
I reckon develop, right? Wouldn't you think the develop's potential entry to pick up Essential might have been a bit of a play to, you know, to leverage off of that position to try and get their hands on this?
Well, it definitely provides that optionality to see how it plays out.
And it also puts, if they did get that, puts them in a, you know, an even better position for a future takeout from MinRes, mate, because that's your theory all along.
Yeah, mate, it's got to bloody come true. But like MinRes, you think of it from MinRes's point of view, getting developed to, you know, go into Essential and potentially if they got into anything like this, it gives them like double the chance of getting stuff done because you've got another company driving it for you as well. So there's definitely a good relationship there with all the shareholdings.
Yep.
So, definitely, mate.
Right, Gascoigne, boys.
Spartan, mate.
Not yet.
No, not yet.
I got to prove it.
Ding, ding, ding for you too.
Yep.
No, ding, not ding, me. Ding. Oh, my partner has some shares, but yeah, ding, ding, ding.
By extension.
Ding, ding, ding. No, ding, ding, ding for me. I see this whole, look, this is great. Congratulations to Simon. But look, I'd appreciate if he put a bit more attention into his non-executive director roles where I hold all my shares. So
you get him on the blower, mate. Sort him out.
Right, headline.
Headline, Dalgaranga.
Significant mineral resource update for the infamous Never Never. So that total, the Dalgaranga mineral resource.
I think Gilby's would be the infamous.
Well, this is now famous.
Famous.
So Dalgaranga, they've now got 1.18 million ounces at 2.2 grams. So,
In the resource.
So, but the Never Never deposit, which is the new new good thing that come out of Gascoigne, that is not the Gilbies. It's sort of part of Gilbey's North. So their underground resource is now 630,000 ounces at 7.6 grams a tonne. And the open pit component of it's 91,000 ounces at 2.24. So, yeah, the Never Never total is 721,000 ounces at 5.85 grams a tonne at 76% indicated. So a lot of ounces added and a lot more confidence added as well. So, if you look at what this was to the previous mineral resource, it was at 303,000 ounces at 4.64. So it's over doubled the ounces, and grade has also increased by 26%, and the indicated level is at 76. So it's a good, very good result for them. So
where's the share price at today?
Up 15%, 23.5 cents they're sitting at now. So remember they recapped at 10 cents. When we had Simon on, and he got the grilling from the Mr. Ricciardo about possible outcomes, so they're actually back to, I guess, the share. So if you were a shareholder and they all went to shit, did the recap, you now got your money back. So the share price is back at that point. So it's good for long term shareholders in a way that they've brought this price back up.
Yeah, I think they've still got a long way to go on that front. There was a lot of dilution and whatnot, but they're on the right track. Speaking of the interview we had with Simon Lawson, the MD, for those wondering, the MD of Gascoigne Resources, he really stressed the 365 goal or strategy, whatever you call it, that Gascoigne had. And one of the key pillars of that strategy was the 600,000 ounces at 5 grams plus And, you know, it seems quite straightforward, almost predictable that this was coming. This was like exactly what they were aiming to do. It was, if you just look at the performance rights, we touched on them a couple of weeks ago when they came out. There was five different classes of performance rights. And we'll show them on the screen. We can skim through them. But Never Never Ore reserve at 4 grams per ton, greater than 300,000 ounces. Resource of greater than 5 grams per ton for 600,000 ounces. Then a share price exceeding 30 cents for 60 days. Dalgaranga restart, final investment decision. And finally, Dalgaranga production of 300 ounces for each day for a 45-day period. So, yeah, they've checked off one of those. They're going to get their performance rights, the Lawson and the four other directors, and they're, you know, on good footing to get those other four.
Well, it's interesting, right, because they were proposed in a notice of meeting on the 4th of July, but shareholders will vote on that on the 4th of August. So they'll get the performance rights approved on the 4th of August and they'll immediately vest into shares.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think it just goes...
Your shout, Simon.
It just goes to the point that we keep on stressing. You look at the incentives and you'll sort of see the outcome, I think.
Yeah.
I think that's really critical here.
I like to see not some bold targets.
That was that was the Warren Buffett quote, wasn't it?
Yeah,
no, Charlie Munger.
Yeah.
Quote from Rick Rule.
Yeah, exactly.
You look at the incentives, you'll see the outcome.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, nevertheless, a really great announcement for the company. And, Matty, you digged up a bit of a comparison to an acquisition that we saw in the last month.
Another one in the news. Before I get into that, another one to look at is that they noted was the discovery cost, like $13 an ounce for mineral for the Never Never. So what they've got, 700,000 ounces. So what's that? $9 million of exploration got them 700,000 ounces at over 5 grams. So that's a pretty standout. That's a function of the ore body.
Yeah.
But you would not see many mines get that lucky to drill a deposit like that on that cost. So $9 million doesn't usually get you that far. So
great helps.
Oh yeah, great. That's what I said. Absolutely kissed on the dick by this ore body. It's 100%. An absolute ripper. So why not? We've done a lot of talk about the Musgrave Remelius, which Westgold had a poke at the start and got the ball rolling. So Remelius are taking over Musgrave for all scrip and a bit of cash. So if you look at the market cap, I'll bring the table up for the YouTube viewers. And
you're comparing
Q Gold project with Dalgaranga. So Gascoigne have got other tenements. We're just going to focus on the Dalgaranga tenement. So if you look at their market caps as a company, so Musgrave is sitting at $210 million. Gascoigne today might be up a little bit from when I checked, $193 million. So they're probably closer to $200 now. That is – so you could infer from that the market is valuing the Remelius takeover of Musgrave at $210 million. Yep. Pretty much takes into account the cash, scrip, the – Musgrave share price is up to 35.5 today. It was implied the value was at 34, but Remelius' share price has gone up as well. So the scrip's valued at more. So if you compare the ounces, so total company resource for the Dalgaranga versus the Q Gold project, Musgrave's is 927,000 ounces. Dalgaranga is 1.18 million. So they're up.
So super similar market caps and relatively similar total ounces. Is that right?
Yes.
And similar grade too, right?
Yeah. Musgrave's only got a 47% measured and indicated, whereas Gascoigne have got 76%, so a lot more indicated there. Grade's pretty much bang on, 2.3 versus 2.2. Now, if you look at the high grade, because that's where the bloody dosh is going to come from.
So sugar.
So the Musgrave's high grade component is 327,000 ounces at 10.4 grams.
They got that from the break a day, Lena.
Their break a day is Gascoigne's Never Never.
Yeah.
That's the best way to compare them. But Gascoigne's is now at 721,000 ounces at 5.85. So it is lower grade. It's a lot bit higher on the measured and indicated, but it's about a bit over double the size. Right now, the underground ounces. So we talked high grade now, underground ounces. So Musgrave have only got 111,000 ounces in their underground resource at 8.7 grams. So they've included 75,000 ounces of that in their stage one PFS at 4.8 grams. So another one of them ones where we show, because they've got those thin loads. It's not one big thing, one big fat ore body like Gascoigne. It just shows what that grade, mineral resource grade, gets converted to once you apply it into mineable shapes and add dilution. So that's another one to look at there. You know, their 10-gram resource mightn't come out at that once you put the underground side in, and whether they blend it all together in the pit. So their head grade will definitely not be 10.4 grams. So then Gascoigne there, Never Never, that's where the beef is, has come from. 630,000 ounces at 7.6 grams per tonne. So they will have, put me bloody dick on it, is that they would have a much better grade and ounce conversion than Musgrave because it's a thicker ore body. So the dilution factors, you still get the same thickness of dilution, but it's over a much wider interval, so that will not reduce the grade as much. So, and the Musgrave underground, they're using pillars, so they lose a bit of that in situ pillars. Whereas again, I'll put me bloody put it on the line that Gascoigne will have a paste plant, so they'll get a higher, pretty much recover all those underground ounces. So,
perfect, mate.
Now the mill capacity. Dalgaranga, 2.5 million ton per annum mill. Musgrave do not have a mill. So, and I've seen reports and stuff that have valued that mill replacement to be about $150 million, could be on the lower side with CapEx blowouts these days. If you build a 2.5 million ton mill for $150 million, that's a pretty good bloody effort. So, and it's been commissioned. It's obviously, there's a bit of restart to get it going. There'll be a bit of money required to do that. But as you mentioned to me, Trav, I guess the mill pricing is being priced into Musgrave now because it's going to be processed by Remelius. So you'd have to look at Musgrave's market cap before the first Westgold offer. So I think were they sitting at about 26 cents, 20 something cents. Westgold took them up to 30 cents.
Yeah, give or take.
Yeah, so their market cap was below 150 mil without a mil. Yeah, but then you look at like Musgrave's grade, like, is a lot higher, that high grade ounces at 10.4 grams. But if you look at the actual, what the ore bodies look like, you look at this picture here of the Musgrave, it's in a lot of lodes, like in there, you know, interloping, like more of a veiny type deposit.
Yeah.
And obviously the resource is just the sum of all of those. But then you look at what the Gascoigne ore body looks like. It's a much more bigger, thicker, not fully continuous, but it's not separated into lodes. It's a big, it's a bigger single ore body. That's what we've seen from the 10 to 20 plus meter hits.
It looks more fun to mine, that one.
Yeah. Well, fun. Easy is fun usually. Yeah. So, but as we said, a lot of the stuff coming out of the Musgrave one is coming from open pit, so it's all just going to be blasted up and blended together, you would assume. There'd be high grade, some grade mixing there.
And there's been a couple exploration hits that Gascoigne have that they haven't included in this resource. So I think Ink is the name of the sort of discovery that they'd poked a few holes in. And it'd be interesting.
Is that the hanging wall load, or that was another one? There was a hanging wall load outside of the Never Never, or is that another one you're talking about?
I'd have to double check if that's the right name for that one. But yeah, that, they haven't included that, so it'd be interesting to see if they can, you know, they're clearly looking for lookalikes of Never Never, and it'd be,
And I'm sure there's plenty of exploration potential at Musgrave as well. Like, there's
I'm sure Remelius, if that finalises, they'll have a bit of fun looking.
Yeah, it's interesting, but I think, if you think from an M&A point of view, there'd have to be some people looking to swoop on this at this price. If you're going to get that infrastructure, that amount of high-grade ounces at that confidence for, say they're 193 now, 30% premium on that, $260 million, that's not a bad buy.
It still screens, cheap on paper, there's no doubt. I think, you know, anyone who has a crack at it, the one question that they're going to be really thinking thoughtfully about is how do I sustainably fill that mill up?
Exactly.
It's still a big mill, right?
Yeah, they've still got all the dust from the other, the Dalgaranga, from the Gilby's pit and everything.
Yep.
So I don't think there's a shortness of dirt there to fill it with. It depends if they use just dirt from that tenement just to fill the mill. I know they can definitely run it at a lower throughput, but that will affect the milling cost. might improve recovery a bit.
Yeah, so I'm sure those issues they had with recoveries, you know, they had pretty awful recoveries at the back end of last year. Mm. They haven't been sort of forgotten in investors' minds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll wait and see, boys. Good luck to your shareholdings. Ding, ding, ding as well. Not financial advice.
Ding, ding, ding.
Because these two blokes have got skin in the game.
Core Lithium.
I'm happy to talk about this one, which I don't have skin in the game, thankfully.
Thankfully. This was fascinating. And it's one we'd been sort of looking for an excuse to talk about because, you know, we occasionally look at the most shorted stocks on the exchange, on this the ASX.
Number two. Yeah, number
what
two.
Was it, it was almost 10%.
Yeah, shorted. Super close to 10% yeah. short interest. The announcement today is the quarterly. Yep. And the stock is down 15% yep. intraday, smacked.
And it's a sizable company. I think before the announcement today, it was like $1.8 or $1.7 billion dollar company.
About $1.7 billion dollar company, massive.
Yeah, so give us a bit more of the background. We listened to the quarterly this morning and it was, you know, an uninspiring.
Or the quarterly.
I thought it was a.
That was a good one.
It was good, mate. It was good.
Oh, I got it.
Got it. Decided not to laugh.
I thought it was a pretty challenging earnings call to listen to personally. Yeah. And so just a bit of context to the listeners. Core Lithium, they've got the Finniss Lithium Project in the Northern Territory and it's just begun producing spodumene concentrate there. You mentioned, JD, that it's the second most shorted stock and you pointed it out to me today that the broker recommendations out there for this company, you've got two buys, two holds and five sells. That's a lot of negative price targets, which yeah. you know in an industry where it's pretty easy to chuck a buy on stuff and pretty hard to chuck a sell on something. That's you don't see that distribution too often.
Agreed, mate. Agreed.
Yeah, and you might be wondering why such a high percentage of shorts when the company has $153 million cash balance, because we've talked about. You know, a lot of the companies that have a high short interest, the play there is you short it because the company's got a funding gap and then you can close out that short by participating in a placement at a discount. But if they've got $153 million of cash, you're probably thinking, where's the funding gap? I can't see that. So I'm keen to talk about two things that, you know, probably are informing the short thesis there. One is the degree of capital expenditure that's still required. So Core, they're currently mining from Grants Pit, but Grants Pit has a relatively short mine life there and they need to bring BP 33 online to have, you know, sustainable production beyond about FY26.
So they flagged on the call this morning that BP 33 is going to become that cornerstone asset. And I think looking at Core Lithium, you know, how they were sort of looked at was they were a company that was sort of racing to production mm-hmm. and they had these sort of satellite things. They've built a mill, obviously, and they're just trying to get there quickly and then they'll add to it. They'll spend on exploration and so on. And yep. it looks like that exact sort of model is what investors are kind of critiquing them on, I guess.
Yeah. And the other point I want to talk about, you know, in addition to the CapEx is what their current performance is versus expectations of where the market was benchmarking. So let's talk about where things came out today, right? The announcement today, we find out that recovery is currently 49%, which is way lower than the DFS. The DFS modeled flatline recovery of 71.7% life of mine.
That's like Mount Catlin recoveries, isn't it?
Yeah.
Pretty ordinary.
Super, 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 super tough stuff there. So recovery 49%. You've got the concentrate grade, so spodumene concentrate grade of 5.35%. That's lower than the DFS, which penned a 5.8% grade on that very specific one.
They had some issues with the pit walls as well. So I think that the wording they used was that the walls aren't sort of as competent as they sort of anticipated in the studies that they'd done prior to getting into production.
Yep, and they're producing a lot of fines coming out of the crushing circuit. So much higher volume is from those fines is now going to the tailings and they're currently exploring an option to sell these fines as a byproduct.
So almost everything in comparison to the DFS wasn't coming out quite as they'd hoped.
Because you'd think those, if the pit walls aren't as competent, that means they'd be pretty much means they're falling in, not holding up, which would be diluting the actual blasted lithium ore.
Yep.
And then putting more shit through the mill.
What do you have to do then, Matty? Just angle it differently so they hold better, and that sort of changes the grade and you have more dilution?
Yeah, because you're sort of locked in. You start at that angle, but then if you want to flatten it off more and have a more shallower dipping pit wall, then that changes the design of your pit, and you might actually start losing ore because the pit walls might cut inside the ore body. I haven't got a good look at the wireframe or what this actual cross section looks like, but that if you start doing that, you could potentially lose ore.
Yeah,
it stays in the rock forever.
They also came out with some guidance for what to expect in FY24. So the guidance that they're putting out to the market, they're flagging C1 costs around about $1,200 per tonne. And that's 56% above where the consensus estimate at the moment of about $770 per tonne. So despite the brokers, largely, putting a sell on this, the C1 cost is still astoundingly, the guidance is 56% higher cost than where the consensus of those bearish reports are. In addition, that they're saying guidance of 80 to 90,000 tons of spodumene concentrate. That's versus consensus of 129. So production is going to be lower in FY24. So I imagine there's going to be even more downgrades coming from analysts today.
Agreed, man. Some of those consensus numbers that you speak to and those reports outlining a sell recommendation, even those recommendations had price targets well above where the stock's trading today. And once they sort of model in lower forecasted numbers, higher forecasted costs, it sort of points to one direction, doesn't it?
Yep. And the other point to talk about in addition to the operational piece there was I mentioned the expenditure flagged. I'm just going to talk about the expenditure flag for FY24 alone. So keep in mind, you're probably not going to expect that BP33, the bulk of that expenditure, to come until after FY24, but let's just talk about what's penned for FY24. We've got, they say, they're flagging 20 to 25 million on site sustaining capital, 45 to 50 million on deferred waste stripping, 45 to 50 million on BP33 early works, 35 to 40 million on exploration and study expenses. So you add up all of that, you get 145 to 65 million capital costs in FY24 alone. Now, maybe we can start to see the short seller thesis.
Absolutely. That's a lot of money.
I think shareholders should rightly be questioning some of the capital allocation here.
Yeah. What are the ones that stand out most to you?
So 45 to 50 million on BP early works sounds like a hell of a lot to have been approved expenditure given FID hasn't been announced and won't be for another 6 months yet.
Yeah, and it includes things like a box cut and a few other sort of similar items. So
yeah, and the other one, right, is the 35 to 40 million on exploration and study expenditure. So like I'm going to be pretty blunt about my point here. If you're a developer experiencing ramp up issues, be prudent with your capital allocation. Like, do not, under any circumstances, approve an exploration budget that is so lofty that it even puts you at the slightest risk of having to come back and tap the market for more equity, because the market will not be so forgiving if you have to do that. $35 to $40 million on exploration and study expenses when you've got, you're trying to bring on a new ore source seems very, very, very high to me.
Maybe they're putting their workforce through MBAs and stuff. That might be the study expenditure they're talking about.
Well, I just certainly hope they don't have to come, rattling the tin again, because it's going to be pretty ugly if they do.
Well, you mentioned they are the second most shortest stock on the ASX. Mm. Boys, do you know what the first is?
Flight Centre.
Flight Centre, considerably, 11.17% shorted. Yep. Pilbara Minerals is even, I think they're 10th. Yeah, 10th. Pilbara Minerals are the 10th most shorted.
There you go.
7.26%. Beautiful, boys. Good work.
Great stuff, guys.
Words of wisdom from Ricciardo. Love it.
Hootaroo, lads.
Hootaroo.
Oh, wait. We've got a special guest to do Hootaroo for us today.
Right, I bring her in. If anyone's been hearing all the fucking banging and cracking in the background and chairs getting dragged, you wouldn't think this 4-foot thing would create so much noise. Stroth, you've been in the incubator. Put the Hootaroo hat on. Have you had a little session together with two Hootaroo hats on in the bedroom yet?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know who she is. Hootaroo money miners.
Hootaroo.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation and needs.